Hello, this is your Polycast for Tuesday, January 10th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, a land swap for PolyMet and a listening session on police-community relations in Falcon Heights. DFL Governor Mark Dayton's administration is raising concerns about House and Senate Republicans' approach to health insurance premium relief. Dayton's top budget advisor said yesterday that the Republican plan for the state to issue rebates would be complicated, expensive, and slow in delivering its intended benefits. Management and Budget Commissioner Myron Fran said the governor's plan to let the insurance companies handle discounts would provide relief faster and cheaper.
Insurance plans contract with individuals for health insurance. They send them a bill. People pay it. It works. So there's no added cost here. All they need to do is factor in a 25% premium rebate that we're going to reimburse them for. This is the most simple, direct plan I've ever seen government come up with.
Several House and Senate committees are scheduled to take up the Republican-backed bill this week. Republican Senator Michelle Benson says she's willing to be flexible on the bill's details. Minnesota's health commissioner would no longer have authority to expand the use of medical cannabis under legislation introduced in the state house. The 2014 law that created the state's medical cannabis program allows the commissioner to add qualifying conditions. Intractable pain and post-traumatic stress disorder are additions to the original list. Republican Representative Matt Dean of Delwood says the legislature should make those decisions, not the health commissioner. Dean opposed the medical cannabis law and doesn't want any more additions.
There is a slant towards expansion of legalization of marijuana, of different ways that you can get marijuana for different stuff, and that's going to keep expanding until you can smoke it, until it's legal for recreational use. That's the glide path we're on.
Dean chairs the House Health and Human Service Finance Committee. He says he hopes to move quickly on the bill this session. The proposed PolyMet mine has taken another big step forward. The Superior National Forest has approved the exchange of several thousand acres of land in northeastern Minnesota that potentially clears the way for what would be the state's first copper-nickel mine. But the mine still needs key state and federal permits to proceed and could face legal obstacles, as Dan Crocker reports.
PolyMet has been working to develop the mine near Babbitt for the past decade, and company officials are hailing the land swap as a major milestone in that effort. Last March, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources signed off on the project's massive environmental impact statement. That EIS found the project, as designed, could meet state environmental standards. PolyMet CEO John Cherry says this record of decision, or ROD, from the Forest Service is an equally big deal.
I would say that this ranks right up there with acquiring the Erie plant assets that we have on the ground up there. The final EIS and this ROD are probably the three most significant events in the history of this company.
The exchange settles a major difference of opinion between PolyMet and the Forest Service. While PolyMet controls the mineral rights beneath the ground, the Forest Service owned the land where PolyMet hopes to dig. The Forest Service believed an open-pit mine was not permissible on its land, but PolyMet argued its leases gave them the right to mine. And Superior National Forest Supervisor Connie Cummins says the disagreement would likely have gone to court.
And when we weighed it all, you know, we felt that really, again, it was in the best interest to go ahead and exchange the land and not be put in a situation where we may end up with a surface mine on public land.
Under the deal, the Forest Service and PolyMet will swap about 6,700 acres of land. Cummins said the lands the agency will acquire feature a lot of wetlands, including one area that will become a research natural area. But there has been intense opposition to the exchange from Indian tribes and environmental groups. The Forest Service received over 22,000 objections to its draft decision issued last year. Aaron Clems with Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness says it's premature for the Forest Service to trade its land.
Unless and until PolyMet demonstrates that they can meet all federal and state law in the form of receiving permits, there's no reason to transfer thousands of acres of land to them from the public until that process is complete.
Kevin Lee, an attorney with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, says the pollution risks PolyMet poses are the same, whether it's on federal national forest land or private land.
All those risks are still there. All those risks for clean water, the necessity for perpetual water treatment, and the risk that some of those costs are going to get shouldered by taxpayers.
PolyMet Vice President Brad Moore argues that the debate over its mining plan and whether it can meet environmental standards is part of the mine's permitting, not the land exchange.
So the discussion on that will be coming up later this year, and in reality, that is not related to the actual function of the land exchange itself.
PolyMet will need more than 20 federal, state, and local permits before it can begin construction. The company expects regulators to begin issuing draft permits around the middle of this year. Frank Ongaro with Mining Minnesota acknowledges there's still a long regulatory process ahead.
But this shows in a large way for the PolyMet project that the state of Minnesota, with consent from the federal agencies, wants to attract investment to our state, not chase it away.
The decision from the U.S. Forest Service does, though, open the door for potential lawsuits. Environmental groups were mum on their plans, saying they're still reviewing the decision and keeping all their options open. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
About 150 people turned out last night at a meeting in Falcon Heights to talk about police-community relations in the three suburbs served by the St. Anthony Police Department. The U.S. Justice Department set up the session to hear from people after a police officer shot and killed a man last summer. Matt Sepik has more.
The St. Anthony Police Department's 23 sworn officers patrol not only the village of St. Anthony, but also the nearby communities of Lauderdale and Falcon Heights. It was in Falcon Heights on July 6th when Officer Geronimo Yanez shot and killed Philando Castile during a traffic stop along Larpenteur Avenue. Castile's girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, streamed the aftermath live on Facebook, sparking worldwide outrage and protests in the Twin Cities. Yanez faces charges of manslaughter and dangerous discharge of a firearm. Mary Brandenberger with the Justice Department's Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services says the review is not an investigation, either of Yanez or Castile's death.
The St. Anthony Police Department asked us to come in and take a look at some of their policies, practices, training, recruitment, hiring, to take a look at the things that they're working on within their department.
The Justice Department has conducted similar reviews in Philadelphia, Spokane, and San Francisco. Brandenberger says St. Anthony is the smallest law enforcement agency to participate, and community input is key to the collaborative reform process. While DOJ is working closely with St. Anthony Police, no one from the department took part in the first listening session last night at Falcon Heights Elementary School. Most speakers were highly critical of police, saying officers disproportionately target people of color for traffic stops. No one spoke in favor of policing the way it is now. Chantal Allen with Black Lives Matter St. Paul recounted the warning she gave her teenage son when he learned to drive.
When you go past, you have to make sure that you slow down, put your hands at 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. If you have a hat on, turn it forward so you look like a baseball player from around their neighborhood. And don't act agitated when the cops pull you over. I went through a thorough lesson to make sure that my son came home.
An NPR News analysis of St. Anthony Police traffic stop data shows that officers in that department for several years have been ticketing black drivers disproportionately in cases where they had wide discretion to pull someone over. Isaac Milkey is 20 years old and white. He grew up in Falcon Heights and says until Castile's killing, he never understood the stark differences in the way whites and people of color perceive law enforcement.
I've been out past curfew or speeding or whatever a million times, and the prospect of being arrested has never remotely crossed my mind. That's just not a feasible thing that could happen.
The Justice Department says it expects to have recommendations for St. Anthony Police in about 10 months, and plans to spend a year and a half after that helping implement the proposals. DOJ spokesperson Mary Brandenberger says she's unable to say what the incoming Trump administration will do regarding the community-oriented policing program, but she says the department is dedicated to the process. The next listening session is at St. Anthony Village High School at 6:30 tonight, followed by another tomorrow evening at Lauderdale City Hall. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Falcon Heights.
And that's your Polycast for this Tuesday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.